Hi there, dolls, music lovers, and fashion enthusiasts. Welcome to Unveiling the Legends, Dolls of the 60s and 70s, the podcast that takes you on a groovy journey through the lives and legacies of the incredible women who shaped these iconic decades. We are your hosts, Emma
and Abby,
and together we'll explore the stories behind the music, the fashion, and the cultural revolution that defined an era.
Each episode will shine a spotlight on a remarkable woman, from rock and roll rebels to fashion icons, and dive into their impact on the world. We'll uncover the historical context, chat with experts, and celebrate the lasting influence of these trailblazing ladies. So, grab your bell bottoms and get ready to rock and roll as we uncover the untold stories of dolls who left their mark. Let's dive in! Hello, Dolls Pod listeners. This is Editor Abby jumping in before the show properly begins. So in part one of this two-part season finale, we covered the first 30-something years of Yoko's life, from her birth in 1933 up to about 1969, where she marries John Lennon and they get into music and activism together. This part of the episode, part two, will cover the rest of Yoko's life up until now. That being said, I think we both know what's going to happen in this episode. If descriptions of gun violence are too much for you, please skip out on this episode. Take care of yourself. We will join you again another time. Come to find out, that was too much for me. I thought I had it under control. I wrote this episode, thought I got it all out of my system. We sit down and record it. That was absolutely not the case. I go back in a few days later to re-record that chapter. It didn't work. So you are getting this episode as it was recorded about a week ago now. Just wanted to give you guys the heads up, because it's quite jarring and it could be quite upsetting for some listeners. Now that we have the not fun stuff out of the way, let's get into the fun stuff. Let's get into the Dolls Pod Season 2 finale episode. So you know how I said in literally the last episode that this show getting to the season finale is held together by duct tape and safety pins?
Yeah. What broke?
So I just went outside to bring my dog to the bathroom, because the world is his bathroom pretty much everywhere but inside this house. And I take him for a little walk to the corner and back, just so the old guy can get his steps in. And I go to get my mail. And my mailbox is open with my mail and the lid.
Oh boy.
Then the front of it in the mailbox. This poor mailman just happened to open the mailbox at the same time both of the screws just happened to rust out.
Oh no, he probably felt so bad.
We got boots being held together by duct tape and E6000 and a mailbox in several pieces. Welcome to the season finale.
We've been through it.
How are you feeling?
I'm feeling great. I really am. I feel like I wasn't feeling so well a couple of weeks ago because I was so nauseous and I don't even know, it just all came back. But now I'm doing a lot better. I'm feeling okay. A little bit of pain here and there, back pain, all of that, but that's fine. The only thing that is still a little up in the air is that this baby, just like my son, decided to turn around last minute and is now in breech position, which would mean I would need a C-section, which I don't love, but also I'm not going to go into any risk. If that is the medical way to go, if doctors say it's the safest way, I'm going to do it. So, yeah.
So I have two questions that I'm sure our listeners are wondering about. Number one, do you have the nursery set up?
Nothing. We have nothing ready. Nothing packed. I was always like, so we are recording this right now. Today I have 6 more weeks until my due date. So I'm okay. But yeah, we still have a lot of things to do because I'm just like, this is the second baby. I have everything that I need, which I'm not sure about because maybe there's something I'm not thinking about. So I just told my husband today, I was like, I'm going to go and record a podcast tonight. You go up in the attic and see what's there. We need to bring everything out.
Good idea to make your husband do that.
Yes. At some point, I should pack a bag just in case because you never know. What if? Yeah, I told him, like, we need to install the car seat. We need to get on to things now. But yeah, we'll get there. I'm a lot more relaxed this time around.
And second question.
Yes.
You do not have to tell us the names because I know you don't do that.
Yeah.
For the privacy of your children. But do you have names narrowed down?
We do have it narrowed down to two. We're gravitating a little more towards one. Mm-hmm. I told you, I mean, you obviously know my child's name. And like, yeah. I'm going to tell you what this child is named. We love both names. Like, the good thing is my husband and I were on the same page. We have a very similar taste when it comes to names. So I don't want to say an easy time finding a name, but like, we were always on the same page about names. Mm-hmm. It just took us a while to find one that we liked. Mm-hmm. I always feel like I cannot say with certainty that this child is going to get this name before seeing the child. Mm-hmm. I have to look at it. What if it doesn't look like one of the names that I'm thinking? So we go in, we have the second and third name picked out because it's kind of like a family thing, the way that I am Emma Rosa Katharina after my grandma's. Everyone gets a second and third name that's kind of like in the family. So those two names are set. And then we have two options for the first one. And we're just going to look at the baby and be like, that's the one. That is the plan.
I'm so excited for you.
Me too.
And we can't wait to see a happy, healthy daughter arrive.
Yes, I'm so excited. It's going to be wild. I'm so excited.
So today is our season finale and the final episode of our Dolls Pod Beetle Girl miniseries. Since Emma is very pregnant, she gets to sit back and relax for all of this. And I have gone crazy writing this script.
You have done such a good job going through this.
Thank you. You should hear the voice notes I sent when this was done. I sound like a woman on the edge of reality, let's say that. If you haven't listened to part one yet, it's available on all streaming platforms. Just navigate to our podcast's homepage. Last week, we covered Yoko Ono's early life, her art career through the 1950s and 60s, her first and second marriages, and the beginning of her relationship with her very famous third husband, John Lennon. Only on page 8 of this 24-page script of both episodes together did John and Yoko actually meet. When I told my best friend such, he said, okay, Andrew Hickey, referring to the creator of the legendary A History of Rock Music in 500 Songs podcast. I guess we are wearing our Andrew hats today.
We are.
But I think you'll agree, all of this was just too much for one episode. There's a lot of points of view to account for, and a lot of events to follow. And Sean, if you're listening to this, please don't unfollow me for these episodes about your mom. Without further ado, this is the Dolls Pod Season 2 Finale, Part 2 of Oh Yoko.
Quote, her image stands in contrast to that of other Beatles partners, model-esque white women in chic outfits who occasionally swoop in with kisses, nod encouragingly, and slip away, Amanda Hess wrote for the New York Times. As one of the principal artists of the Fluxus movement, Yoko Ono was famous in the art world. If she hadn't been with John, her work would still be featured in art history textbooks for generations to come. But the art world is a very small world compared to rock and roll. Upon marrying the most famous man in the world, John Lennon, Yoko was suddenly a household name. When she entered and exited the Beatles' headquarters, Apple Corps, crowds hoping to spot a Beatle jeered. where Linda McCartney was also harassed for breaking up the Beatles, attacks towards Yoko were uniquely and horrifically racist. People shouted, "Go back to your own country," and freely called her Jap, an antiquated post-war slur for Japanese people. People also latched onto her fascination with the mantic arts. With her all-black clothes, long black hair, curious calligraphy, and shuffling tarot cards, it wasn't a far cry for people to start calling her a witch. Yoko commented on this in the lyrics of her song, "Yes, I'm a Witch." Quote, "Yes, I'm a witch, I'm a bitch. I don't care what you say, my voice is real. My voice speaks truth. I don't fit in your ways." Close friend of John and Yoko, Klaus Voormann, said, "Bitch was how Yoko was referred to by the men she threatened, and she threatened the lot of them. She refused to be quiet to please anyone." Hurt by public scrutiny, Yoko devoted herself to the things that mattered most to her: art, activism, and John. Their relationship was rooted in attachment issues on both sides. John's absent mother passed away suddenly when he was in school, and his father had walked out on him long before. Yoko's parents were emotionally distant through her whole childhood. They all but disowned her after she performed her cut piece for the first time in her home country of Japan. With John drifting further and further from the Beatles, and Yoko fresh from her split with her second husband Tony Cox, they felt they had no one else. Yoko miscarrying amid the stress of her and John's 1968 drug bust only made their bond stronger. "I was too scared to break away from the Beatles, which I'd been looking to do since we stopped touring," John recounted to Playboy magazine. "When I met Yoko and fell in love, my God, this is different than anything before. This is more than a hit record. This is more than gold. It's more than everything." John and Yoko wanted to replicate their honeymoon bed-ins in New York, but John pleading guilty to a possession charge the year before made it difficult to get into America. Instead, they settled in Montreal. There, they were visited by conservative cartoonist Al Capp. When he accused the couple of staging the bed-ins for money, not peace, John said, "Do you think I could earn money by some other way, sitting in bed for 7 days, taking shit from people like you? I could write a song in an hour." Al called Yoko Madame Nu, the name of the First Lady of Vietnam. Al calling Yoko Madame Nu reflected stereotype of the Dragon Lady, of East Asian women being deceitful, domineering, and aggressive. John was enraged, but kept his cool. He doubled down on his "A Song in an Hour" quip, writing "Give Peace a Chance." Released in July of 1969, this would be the first single by the Plastic Ono Band.
Plastic Ono Band wasn't a real band, Yoko explained. Like some of her conceptual art, her group with John and his friends was solely a band by name. Anyone could be in the Plastic Ono Band. Allen Ginsberg, Timothy Leary, Jim Keltner, Ringo Starr, even Eric Clapton. In the Classic Albums episode about John's Plastic Ono Band album, Yoko explained the concept further. Sort of. Quote, "There was an offer from Berlin that I should do a concert, and I thought, why don't I do a very original concert and have tape recorders and radios and plastic stands inside, like those are the people. I liked that idea, but couldn't do it because I got together with John. He said, oh, like this, and took plastic objects around the bathroom, like the toothbrush cup, arranged them, and said, like this? This is Plastic Ono Band." The Plastic Ono Band ran surreal ads in the music press with many images of plastic things Xeroxed on top of each other and the Jones page of the telephone book. "You are the Plastic Ono Band," it read. Though John and Yoko were married, efforts to blend their families were tough. Throughout the whole 1968 section of part one of this episode, Kyoko, Yoko's first child, just kind of isn't mentioned. And that's because Yoko all but abandoned her to go live with John.
Yeah.
Tony Cox, Kyoko's father, was hostile, rarely allowing his daughter to see her mother and John. At the same time, Yoko was icing Cynthia Lennon and John's son Julian out. When Julian would call, the calls would always go through Yoko. Yoko would say something like, oh, he's sleeping, oh, he's busy, oh, he's at the studio. Julian wouldn't speak to John because of this for months at a time, even years. In June of 1969, though, both Kyoko and her stepbrother Julian were allowed to visit John and Yoko at their Tittenhurst home. The whole blended family went on vacation in Scotland, seemingly without okaying it with Tony or Cynthia. John was famously a very bad driver. He was legally blind without his glasses. When they were on and he was behind the wheel, he drove way too fast. On July 1st, 1969, John lost control of the car and drove it into a ditch. Yoko injured her back, and she, John, and Kyoko all sustained cuts. John needed 17 stitches, and Yoko 14 on her forehead. Julian was treated for shock, but miraculously was otherwise fine. When Cynthia heard about what happened, she was furious. How dare her ex-husband and this random woman take Julian to a foreign country without asking? How dare they put him in that kind of danger?
Rightfully so. Honestly, I feel like once you...
If that was your son?
I would have... Yes. I would have been so, so mad. Because as a parent, I feel like you want to know where your child is and you want to know if your child is safe. I mean, this was a very complex situation. We spoke about it in part one. There was never a ground for this to have a good start or anything. Mm-hmm. And I have to say, I applaud Cynthia and Yoko for making up along the way.
They were civil.
Put their differences behind them.
I don't know if I would have extended that civility, especially considering the crash.
Like, yes.
Wildly irresponsible.
Even if I'm not home and my husband is doing something with my son, I want to know what they do. Not even because I think something bad's going to happen, but I just want to know
God forbid.
What's going on. Yeah. It's always good to know, okay, they're on a bike ride, whatever. The idea of taking your child to a different country without telling anyone is just so wild.
They were so entitled, they didn't care. Yeah,
and that sucks. It really, really sucks.
When John and Yoko returned to England, John kept bringing the bedridden Yoko into the studio. For most all of Abbey Road sessions, Yoko laid in bed watching. Dan Richter remembers delivering white packets to her in bed, those white packets being heroin. John and Yoko's addiction was set against the slow, messy breakup of the Beatles. It was fueled by many factors, the death of Brian Epstein in 1967, their fallout with the Maharishi and the disastrous White Album sessions in 1968, and Alan Klein weaseling his way into the picture through 1969. While Yoko didn't break up the Beatles, she certainly didn't help the matter. Come August, John and Yoko were desperate to kick heroin. They went 36 hours cold turkey, which is extremely dangerous. On the B-side of John's Cold Turkey was Yoko's song, Don't Worry, Kyoko. This was the first single to feature her distinct, shrieking vocalizations. John and Yoko's buddies at Rolling Stone, remember they were in Good with Jan Wenner, called them, quote, a mournful caterwaul of despair. Others weren't quite as kind. She would perform Don't Worry Kyoko in September at a star-studded rock and roll concert for peace. All of John's heroes would be there, Bo Diddley, Little Richard, and Chuck Berry. Even today, you see YouTube uploads of Yoko joining John and Chuck on stage, and having her mic cut off. They claim Chuck was so mad and John was so embarrassed. In reality, the situation was planned. But it was a situation of right message, wrong place. Screaming for peace just doesn't work at an old school legacy rock and roll show.
No, it just over and over again, so impressed by Yoko being so brave. Like she does all of these
things.
She puts herself out there constantly. And I applaud her for that. I think that is incredibly impressive. Sometimes you have to ask yourself whether this was a good idea. It's as simple as that.
Time and place.
Yes.
A month after Abbey Road's release in September came John and Yoko's next album, Wedding Album. When the Beatles were awarded MBE medals by the Queen, John sent his back with a letter. Quote, "In protest against Britain's involvement in the Nigeria Biafra thing, against our support of America in Vietnam, and against cold turkey slipping down the charts. With love, John Lennon of Bag."
They did have great humor. You have to give them that. Their humor is impeccable. Allen Ginsberg came up with the idea that simply saying war is over will eventually end the war. Phil Oakes organized his War is Over demonstration with Jerry Rubin, Abbie Hoffman, and Paul Krassner out in California. The idea was anything new, but John and Yoko took it to a whole new level, making it part of their mission statement and brand. In 1969, the War Is Over If You Want It, Happy Christmas from John and Yoko billboard first appeared in Times Square. This eventually became their Christmas classic. Happy Christmas, War Is Over. To ring in 1970, John and Yoko cut their hair short and declared Year One AP, with AP standing for After Peace. Just popping in here because we spoke about their cool looks. They really rocked that. Mm-hmm. It takes a person to rock a buzz cut, but it looked great on both of them.
It was such a statement against, like, 1969 and 1970. Everyone still had the long hair and the full beards.
Yeah.
And they ditched that in quite an extreme fashion. Honestly, kind of a jab at the military buzz cut as well.
Yeah, I like it. And the message behind it was fantastic. There were other things about them that I think you can and have to rightfully criticize them for. But this narrative of everything Yoko Ono has ever touched is absolutely horrible just doesn't sit right with me, because this, for example, was a great way to make a cause known to the public. The spring of 1970 was chaos. Paul McCartney dropped his McCartney album, and the Beatles had officially broken up. Yoko was public enemy number one. While Yoko and John were very excited to welcome another child, they were nervous about announcing such considering how their last pregnancy went. At the same time, Jan Wenner expressed interest in conducting his interviews with John, and inevitably Yoko too, for Rolling Stone magazine. To combat depression, John took up Dr. Arthur Janoff's primal therapy. He traveled to LA for 4 months, much longer than he was legally allowed to try this experimental new therapy. The idea was for the therapist to guide the patient into a childlike state. There, the patient would be reduced to screaming and crying in the fetal position. The idea was that this would resolve childhood trauma. After crying it out, you would feel much lighter. This scream therapy inspired John to scream through Plastic Ono Band songs like Mother. Mother, you left me, but I never left you. I needed you, but you didn't need me. Daddy, come home. Mama, don't go.
Daddy, come home.
When Janoff requested to film John, him and Yoko refused. When they flew back to Tittenhurst, Yoko received a doll in the mail, stuck with pins. Soon after, in August of 1970, she miscarried. Her equivalent to John's Plastic Ono Band contains her expression of grief on why. She cries out, why, over and over again. Both John and Yoko's Plastic Ono Band albums together are nothing short of harrowing. To promote the albums, John and Yoko granted an extensive interview to Esquire magazine. It turned out to be horrifically racist. The headline read, John Renan's exclusive gloopy, on the load to Briss with Yoko Nobody Onos.
Read how it's spelled, by the way. This was very intentional.
Yes. This is
terrible to begin with, but it gets worse.
Unfortunately, it does. A full-page drawing accompanied the feature, a caricature of Yoko with a tiny John as a beetle on a leash.
I could not believe this when I read it, but I Googled it. I found scans of the pages from Esquire magazine. It's so bad.
It is so racist. To cope with it all, in 1971, Yoko made another film. Film number 11, Fly, featured a model laying naked on a bed, painted in sugar water and swarmed by flies. Flies became a recurring motive in Yoko's work. They were a key component in her trolling the MoMA in 1972. The hapless task of obtaining flies becomes a running gag in the one-to-one John and Yoko film. Quote, "There's all sorts of levels of understanding, I'm sure," Yoko said about Fly, "but it has something to do with the life of a woman. The fly is crawling over you and you're just taking it." Her and John's calls for peace manifested in much more conventional terms, too. One morning at Tittenhurst, John sat at the piano, mulling over how many of Yoko's instructional pieces from the 60s required the viewer to imagine. Imagine letting a goldfish swim across the sky. Imagine the clouds dripping. Imagine 1,000 suns in the sky at the same time. This snowballed until, imagine there's no heaven. It's easy if you try. No hell below us, above us only sky. The result was John's greatest hit.
No hell below us, above us only sky.
Though it's pretty rich, a song about imagining no possessions came from one of the richest men in the world. The sentiment made it his most enduring and beautiful song. Imagine ranks at number 3 on Rolling Stone's Greatest Songs of All Time list. The music video, made several years later, features him and Yoko strolling through darkness to their house. Yoko opens the curtains to their all-white music room. She sits next to John at the piano and, once the song concluded, they stare at each other. John makes a funny face and Yoko breaks, leaning in. As they kiss, the video ends in a freeze frame. It's beautiful. It simply is. It's an incredible song.
When I was in middle school and later high school, because this teacher actually moved to the high school while we were still there, my class was at least, I had this U.S. history teacher in eighth grade when I had her for the first time. And she did this again in, I think, 11th was the second time. When something really scary happened in the world, when something really scary and bad happened, she printed out all the lyrics to Imagine, and in class the next day, she would hand them out to all of us, and all class was just us listening to Imagine once with the lyrics in front of us, and then class was dismissed. We could work on our homework, just sit there and, like, talk it out. That really helped. I still think of her. It was a beautiful thing to do. She was part of that generation that just idolized John Lennon, that just loved him so much, and he was the paradigm of world peace.
Yeah.
And it was such a simple thing for her to do for us, but I still think about it to this day. Like, half my life later, I still think about that.
I hate to break the wonderful moment with you and your teacher, but I have to share what I think about when Imagine comes up. And that is a very specific scene from Glee. We've talked about it, you and I.
That's right, we both watched Glee.
And for so...
God, the early 2010s were a fever dream, were they not?
Glee was such a fever dream. It's so unhinged. But there was this one very wholesome scene where the Glee Club is singing Imagine with another school's Glee Club, I believe. And all the students there are deaf. And so they also sing it in sign language. That picture has stuck with me because it is such a wholesome moment on this crazy show.
As John and Yoko built their utopia in song, Yoko's untenable relationship with her ex-husband Tony worsened. He had remarried in late 1969, so marriages weren't the problem. Custody of Kyoko was their main point of contention. In this time, John and Yoko were absolutely not fit parents. They were addicted to heroin, they would lose track of time, there are no set bedtimes or meals when your parents are addicts. On the other hand, Tony was unpredictable, volatile, and paranoid. He took off to Spain with Kyoko. Yoko and John flew there and kidnapped Kyoko from her preschool. If you'll remember from our episode about Cynthia Lennon, this all echoes John's early life. His own father tried to kidnap him and take him to New Zealand. While Kyoko was excited to see her mom again, she was terrified of the fight that would inevitably follow. It was even worse than she could have imagined. John and Yoko were arrested, and when they all gathered at a hearing, the judge made Kyoko choose which parent she wanted to live with. She chose Tony. At first, he allowed Kyoko to visit Tittenhurst, but the visit slowed to a stop. After John and Yoko got clean off heroin, and after months of not seeing her daughter, John ordered their lawyers to track her down, to no avail. Yoko was heartbroken. To accompany John's Imagine album, Yoko released Fly and issued another edition of her Grapefruit book. These were the couple's last creative projects before moving to New York for good. They did this in part because Yoko loved the city since childhood, and part in hopes to find Kyoko. They settled in Greenwich Village, which Yoko had frequented in her beatnik days. New York was a breath of fresh air. Fans and paparazzi were slightly more respectful, and the couple could start getting into activism in the United States. They held a concert in Ann Arbor, Michigan to free John Sinclair, the White Panther Party leader sentenced to 10 years in federal prison for possession of marijuana. All loops back to this universe eventually. The audience of this show was full of FBI informants. So began the United States government's obsession with kicking John out of the country. They feared his communist messages of world peace and anti-war activism, how dare he, could incite the youth against the government. The couple's ambitious tour to free prisoners nationwide, or at least the idea they had, became one of the subjects of the one-to-one John and Yoko documentary. At the same time, Yoko announced her exhibition at the Museum of Modern Art. She didn't really have an exhibition lined up there. It was all a joke. Her announcement in the Village Voice featured her just below the MoMA sign, with the giant F on her bag lined up with the word art. For but a moment in time, it was the Museum of Modern Fart.
This is brilliant.
Take that, those who think modern art is stuffy.
As said, Yoko has a great sense of humor. She's so funny.
She's funny.
Like, that is brilliant.
People who turned up to the museum hoping to see her work were met with a sign that said she'd released flies sprayed with her perfume all over the city. The first person to find them all won nothing. Because there were no flies in the first place. The search for Kyoko continued. John and Yoko's lawyers advised to file for custody in the U.S. Virgin Islands. While the judge actually ruled in their favor, it didn't do anything. Both Tony and Kyoko failed to show up. Tony was jailed for truancy on Christmas Eve. When he got out, he took Kyoko and went off the grid. For years, he would be wanted for kidnapping. For years, Yoko searched. John made appeals on national television in search of Kyoko. Could you imagine if something like this happened today?
It does. I just read about it. Now that we're speaking of it, I just read about it that somewhere in Australia, this man was seen with his children whom he kidnapped in Denmark or something, and the mother has been searching for them for years. Really makes you wonder whether if this would have happened even back then to someone who was more beloved, whether these search efforts would have been different. It almost feels like this was a power thing more than it was about what is good for my child. And that breaks my heart, because your child should be, in questions like this, be your first priority. In March of 1972, a deportation notice was quietly slipped under John and Yoko's door. President Nixon's Attorney General, John Mitchell, agreed that deporting John would save them many headaches, as they said. The years-long fight for John's citizenship began. Only in 1976 would the government finally relent, granting him his green card. The couple's issues with substances continued, this time with methadone. In this drug-fueled haze, John made his Sometime in New York City album. Yoko's good friend, radio DJ Elliot Mintz, was granted permission to debut the album in full on his show. What is the first song of that album? John's statement about how women are treated in society. Woman is the N-word of the world. The album was immediately banned from radio play for obvious reasons. Elliot played the album in full, but he was fired. The uproar surrounding this song was truly historic. It remains a point of hot contention among John Lennon fans, who reach for their fast-forward buttons in a panic when they hear that saxophone kick in.
Sidebar. Your Honor, sidebar. We gotta talk. This is objectively the most insane thing John and Yoko ever did.
You would almost think it wouldn't be so easy to pinpoint down the most sane thing.
But it is.
How can you insult so many people with one song? How? Wow. It's wild.
Here's the thing. Woman Is was a clumsy attempt to recontextualize the N-word for the plight of women in patriarchal society. I'm not denying the plight of women. It's part of why this podcast exists and all. John had good intentions. So did Yoko, who first expressed this woman is the N-word sentiment in interview in 1968, which was a phrase that in and of itself came from a sentiment expressed by a black female author, which adds a whole other layer to this. They were surrounded by yes men telling them, oh, you should totally do this. It'll be so transgressive. John should not have done it. Yoko shouldn't have done it either. It was not their word to reclaim. Point blank. Period. This would never fly today. But Woman Is was part of a trend of white people in the 70s saying the N-word with a hard R in their songs. For some reason, it wasn't Patti Smith's word to reclaim either. Dylan had reason to use it in Hurricane, but if I were his manager, I would have advised strongly against it. John was not exercising discretion with Woman Is, and apparently neither was the record company. I don't know how they let this thing fly all the way through to release, let alone to the radio. Poor decision making all around, leading to the most insane thing John and Yoko ever did. And the next lyric, John just says, think about it.
Yeah, the world thought about
Woman
it.
Is
guess
the
what?
N-word of the world. Think about it. Oh,
everyone
Jesus.
Thought about it, and somehow everyone else realized right off the bat that this is not a comparison you can make.
This is a terrible idea.
Yeah.
Editor Abby jumping in one more time for a very pertinent update to this very conversation. In the time since we recorded this episode,
the John Lennon Estate has announced a sometime in New York City era box set of live recordings, Woman Is, has been deleted from that running order. I'm generally not into altering an artist's work from how it was originally intended to be presented to the viewer or listener or whatnot, but this is a case in which the estate is exercising the necessary discretion that John and Yoko did not in 1972. So, well played, John. Well played.
Yoko's accompanying album was Approximately Infinite Universe,
which I actually like.
There are some great songs on that one.
There are some good songs.
In the title track, Yoko sings, not screams. In this approximately infinite universe, I know a girl who's in constant hell. No love or pill could keep her cool, 'cause there's a thousand holes in her heart. It's hard not to see this as a response to not only the stress of their move to the Dakota and John's constant troubles with immigration, but John's flagrant infidelity at one of their parties. She claimed it didn't hurt her, but she agreed something had to change. For about a year and a half, John and Yoko separated. It was Yoko who set John up with their young assistant, May Pang, who this show absolutely loves.
We love May!
Yoko simply remembered, May Pang was a very intelligent, attractive woman and extremely efficient. I thought they'd be okay. This period of separation, when John and May moved to California and John spiraled into alcoholism with Harry Nilsson, is remembered as the Lost Weekend. This period was the subject of a 2022 documentary, The Lost Weekend, A Love Story, which prominently features May. David Sheff frames this period as freeing for Yoko. She released her Feeling the Space album and played a series of successful concerts in Japan. But in her memoir, Loving John, May remembers Yoko calling constantly and keeping a tight hold on John. On one occasion, Yoko called John to inform him May had a boyfriend sometime before seeing him. John was a jealous guy. While on a plane, he flew into a drunken, jealous rage and repeatedly pulled May's hair. When John suddenly broke up with her to get back together with Yoko in 1975, May was convinced she hypnotized him. Once again, it just feels like in the story of Yoko and John, people are used and just tossed.
Mm-mm.
And that doesn't sit right with me.
And it's super disappointing to see John lapse back into domestic violence a couple times in May's account of their relationship. And like Yoko planting the seeds to manipulate the whole situation, that feels icky to me too.
But it does kind of go back for me to what we spoke about in the first episode, that Yoko maybe was the only person who met John on eye level. Because the way that he felt above Cynthia and the way that he treated her kind of came back when he was with May.
Mm-hmm.
And so I feel like, I don't want to say he was afraid of Yoko, but like in a sense he felt like he couldn't do this with her.
Mm-hmm.
John and Yoko announced to the public they were back together, but Yoko was apprehensive. John needed to kick his alcoholism before they moved forward. Their time apart had changed Yoko. She felt she was now confident enough to stand on her own. She was even more anxious about things when she discovered she was pregnant again. This time, they waited, in case anything happened during. It was not easy. Yoko was bedridden for much of her pregnancy, but things were looking up. John's latest solo album, Rock and Roll, was enjoyed by critics and fans. On October 7th, 1975, the U.S. Court of Appeals overturned the previous decision to deport him. 2 days later, on John's 35th birthday, Yoko went into labor. There were complications. She began to hemorrhage and needed a blood transfusion. The nurse mistakenly gave her the wrong blood type, and Yoko started convulsing. When the doctor arrived, he went straight to John and shook his hand, saying, "I've always wanted to meet you, Mr. Lennon. I always enjoyed your music." John exploded. My wife's dying, and you want to talk about my music? The mistake was corrected, and that night, their beautiful boy arrived. Sean Ono Lennon was born. A hard road to hoe. Yes, it's a long way to go. But in the meantime, before you cross the street, take my hand. Life is what happens to you while you're busy making other plans. Beautiful, 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 beautiful boy. Darling, 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 darling Sean. John began his new life as a stay-at-home dad, a choice criticized by patriarchal society. Finally, he was ready to be a father. I don't feel guilty, Yoko said. Having come from a family of businessmen, she handled the family's business affair. It may not be the same as other mothers, but I'm doing it the way I can do it. In general, mothers have a very strong resentment toward their children, even though there's this whole adulation about motherhood and how mothers really should think about their children and how they really love their children. I mean, they do, but it's not humanly possible to retain emotion that mothers are supposed to have within this society. Women are just too stretched out in different directions to retain that emotion. Too much is required of them, Yoko said of the societal expectations to be the career woman and perfect mother. I am carrying the baby 9 months, and that is enough. You can take care of it afterwards. I do think that this is a discussion that is much more popular now. When people speak about fathers stepping up more and taking more of a role, that whole picture of like the dad that doesn't know his children's birthdays, doesn't know who their friends are and doesn't know all of that. And I think Yoko, she's very smart. She understood this. And what she's saying here, it is kind of groundbreaking almost to say that in this society, it's starting to get a lot more popular here, at least for dads to take off time off work several months sometimes to stay home with the child. I have friends who the mom stayed home for a year and then the dad stayed home for a year. People are much more having this conversation nowadays. It's great. I think it is great that John said, I'm going to be a stay-at-home dad. There's nothing wrong with it. And it is brave of them, once again, to just do that in the society that they lived in. The only thing about all of this that doesn't sit right with me is the fact that neither of them did this for their first child.
Yes. Yeah. Cynthia writes about hearing Beautiful Boy and seeing how involved John was with Sean and being angry. Like, you couldn't give this to Julian? Julian's a perfect child. Why couldn't you give this to him too?
I fully understand where she was coming from. And at the same time, it is beautiful that they did this for Sean. It really is.
You just wish John and Yoko had felt ready to be parents the first time around.
In that situation, you still have to step up for your child because you got pregnant. That is not just happening to you.
Yoko is not the Virgin Mary.
Certainly not.
Yoko handled the business while consulting a team of astrologers, numerologists, tarot card readers, and psychics. Yoko was a very superstitious woman. If the vibes weren't right, she'd can a meeting. This really tested the patience of the other Beatles, especially Paul, who felt Yoko was intentionally doing this for the sole purpose of keeping John away from them. Friend of theirs Mick Jagger remembered, quote, "He was living close to where I was living in New York City, but I was probably considered one of the bad influences, so I was never allowed to see him after that." This didn't prevent the Beatles from reconciling, though. Paul and John had gotten closer during his lost weekend. They watched SNL together at the Dakota one night, and even considered taking up Lorne Michaels' appeal to reunite the Beatles on air. This was the subject of the 2000 film Two of Us. Now that John had his green card, him and Yoko were free to travel. John had always wanted to go sailing. A trip he took with Sean to Bermuda inspired one of his many, many songs to Yoko. This one was his ultimate profession of love. Just like starting over.
Let's take a chance and fly away somewhere alone. It's been too long since we took the time. No one's to blame. I know time flies so quickly.
This bore John's next joint album with Yoko and his grand return to music after a 5-year hiatus. The album was to be called Double Fantasy. It would be a conversation between John and Yoko, with alternating songs by them. John says it's just like starting over. Yoko says kiss, kiss, kiss. Yoko says yes, I'm your angel. John says woman. John says beautiful boy. Yoko says beautiful boys. In the fall of 1980, David Sheff embarked on his extensive interviews of John and Yoko for Playboy magazine. Upon his interview request, Yoko's assistant asked him for his birth date, time, and birth location. Yoko needed his birth chart and life path number to give him the okay. Whatever David's rising sign is, it must have checked out, because he interviewed John and Yoko morning and night across 3 whole weeks. The result is a picture of a much less angry John than he was in his Rolling Stone interviews. He's made peace with his traumas and the breakup of the Beatles, and is open and expressive about being a stay-at-home dad. He was mending his relationship with Julian. He was optimistic about his future, and his anger had dissipated. Quote, "Life begins at 40, so they promise. Oh, I believe it too, because I feel fine. I'm, like, excited. It's like 21, you know, hitting 21. It's like, wow, what's going to happen next?" On December 7th, 1980, 2 weeks after Double Fantasy's release, the interview hit the newsstands. The next morning, John and Yoko were photographed by Annie Leibovitz for a cover story in Rolling Stone magazine. Though the cover shot would have Freud rolling in his grave, it was John's idea to be pictured naked in the fetal position, curled up next to Yoko. Quote, "He wanted to expose his vulnerability and dependence, reveal a portrait of a couple in which the man finally let his guard down after suffering from machismo that nearly killed him and almost destroyed his marriage, show that he was dependent on a woman, Yoko." After signing a copy of Double Fantasy for a fan outside the Dakota, John and Yoko headed to the studio to work on Yoko's song, Walking on Thin Ice. At about 10:30, they decided to stop back at the Dakota before going out to dinner to say goodnight to Sean. As their car arrived at the Dakota, John thanked their driver and exited the car. Yoko followed. John always stopped to say hello to fans and sign things for them, so he thought nothing of it when he heard someone call his name. Then the man produced a gun. Oh, God. I was dreading writing this. The man shot John 4 times in the back.
There are no words for this.
What do you even... John managed to stagger into the lobby before collapsing. Yoko followed him inside, screaming for help. The concierge called the police. They arrived within minutes. Seeing John's condition, an officer decided there wasn't time to wait for an ambulance. They had to get to a hospital now. John was laid across the back seat of the police car, speeding to Roosevelt Hospital. Yoko, in a second police car, followed them there. Producer David Geffen rushed to meet Yoko there. She waited outside the trauma room with him. After 15 minutes, a doctor exited the trauma room. "Please tell me he's okay," Yoko pleaded. "I can't tell you that," he replied. A nurse gave her John's wedding band.
Timeout is called. 3 seconds remaining. John Smith is on the line. And I don't care what's on the line, Howard. You have got to say what we know in the booth.
Yes, we have to say it. Remember, this is just a football game. No matter who wins or loses. An unspeakable tragedy confirmed to us by ABC News in New York City. John Lennon, outside of his apartment building on the west side of New York City, the most famous perhaps of all of the Beatles, shot twice in the back, rushed to Roosevelt Hospital, dead on arrival. Hard to go back to the game after that news flash, which in duty bound we had to take. Frank.
John was robbed of a beautiful life. He was finally not angry anymore. He was fixing his relationship with Julian. He was an involved father in Sean's life. Him and Yoko had worked out everything they had to work out. He was coming back to music. It's so wrong. Can I refill my water?
Of course. Really quickly? Do you need anything else?
I need a moment. I'm sorry.
No, it's okay. Are you okay?
Yeah. I couldn't write that without crying. I thought it would be better today. I kind of got it out of my system. I didn't want to have you read that.
That's sweet.
No, it would have torn me.
No.
I didn't want to upset you. It had to be one of us. I have a drink. I splashed some water on my face.
That helps.
It's your chapter anyway, so I can I can kind of decompress for a minute.
I cried while reading that, and then reading the next sentence, I got so angry.
Mm-hmm.
Yoko begged the doctor to delay announcing John's death until she could get home and tell Sean. What she didn't account for was a journalist who just so happened to be in the emergency room for a completely different reason. He called his boss, and John Lennon's death was announced on ABC during the Monday night football game. How does this reporter go to sleep at night?
Such an invasion of privacy.
Yeah. This is like...
it's gross. And violates all manners of journalistic ethics, I'm sure.
Yeah. Yoko described mourning John as the season of glass. She was completely shattered. My mind was like a shattered glass, the sharp points split in tangents. I made myself impossible for anybody to hold me. Everyone was on high alert. Calls were flooding into the Dakota, some threatening to finish the job. One claimed he was John reincarnated and he'd fly a plane into the Dakota if Yoko didn't marry him. Friends removed sharp objects from her kitchen and bathrooms, fearing she'd take her own life. She couldn't do it. She said she couldn't bear to leave Sean alone. It took days for her to explain to 5-year-old Sean what had happened to his father. In wake of his father's death, mother and son became incredibly close. Though she reached out to Julian and invited him to New York, Yoko's treatment of him was distant and strange. When John was alive, Julian didn't like visiting him at the Dakota. He would act erratically. Yoko strong-armed him into wearing John's scarf at a public memorial. In one very controversial decision, Yoko had John cremated. This went directly against his last wishes. At the same time, John was too famous to be buried. The likelihood of his body being disturbed in death was just too high. Julian remembers Yoko asking him if he'd like to touch his father's urn before his ashes were scattered in Central Park. Strawberry Fields and the Imagine Circle were later erected in that area of the park. Julian didn't want to touch the urn, but he did to make Yoko happy. He instantly regretted. The urn was still warm.
people do strange things when they're grieving. Everyone was hurting. Everyone was acting out of character.
I always go by, don't judge someone who's mourning. Mm-hmm. Because everyone's grief is different. Mm-hmm. Just because someone doesn't cry, it doesn't mean that they aren't grieving. There are so many ways to go about this. But I do think that Yoko should have considered Julian more. I don't know if she couldn't because she was just emotionally wrecked. Which
tunnel vision.
I understand. I really do. I don't know.
This whole story, I think of Julian. I've been to Strawberry Fields.
Me too.
It was in the rain. Walked there in the rain the whole way through 20-something blocks. And the area of the Dakota where John and Yoko's car were, that is blocked off to the public. You can't access that location unless you live in the Dakota. But I did see it from the outside. When did you go to the Imagine Circle?
The first time in 2008 with my mom. Mm-hmm. It was so hot. I remember that. It was the middle of summer. It was a bajillion degrees. But we really wanted to go. And there was a guy with a guitar playing.
Unless it's pouring rain and the park is closed, there usually is. That's one of the best parts about it.
Yeah, because then when I went back in early 2020, I was in New York for a month and I went by there every now and then because I really love the park. I think it's a beautiful place. It's very calming. And whenever I came by, someone was playing, no matter the time. And I think that that is very beautiful. And I know that her decision of cremating John is very controversial. And I do understand why people feel like that. And I also do understand why Yoko did make that decision. I wouldn't have wanted to be in her shoes in that situation. Wow. Because how do you even choose? Like, look at what happens at Jim Morrison's grave, for example. It was burglarized several times. It was destroyed. Do you really want that? Like, I can understand why she made that decision. And I do think, in a way, it is beautiful that his memory is now a man who's always standing there with a guitar playing music, people coming by. After John's murder, Yoko experienced crisis after crisis. She had to be incredibly strong to make it through. At least 3 John fans took their own lives. Quote, they ask me, what are you going to do about it? One side of me was saying, how do you expect me to deal with something like that? She received threatening mail. One was a drawing of a gun signed the John's Killer's Name fan club.
We are making the conscious decision not to repeat his name on this show because we all know his motive by now, and saying his name a few more times would give him exactly what he wants. I don't know about you, but I don't want to give him that satisfaction.
No.
It makes me happy that he is denied parole.
Yeah.
And it makes me happy that he couldn't write a book or extort Yoko to be a part of it.
Yoko traveled with full security. Sean remembers bodyguards constantly around through all his childhood. Quote, the bodyguards didn't make it feel safer, he confessed. It made it all worse. Yoko had managed to hang on to John's blood-splattered glasses. She had Bob Grün photograph them on a windowsill in the Dakota next to a glass of water. This shocking photo became her Season of Glass album art and a long-running anti-gun violence billboard. It was the first of many accusations of Yoko profiting off John's death. She said, quote, they said it was bad taste. I felt like a person soaked in blood coming into a living room full of people and reporting that my husband was dead. His body was taken away, and the pair of glasses were the only thing I had managed to salvage. And people were looking at me saying it was in bad taste to show the glasses to them. I'm not changing the cover. This is what John is now. When Double Fantasy won Album of the Year at the Grammys, she solemnly accepted the award on John's behalf as the audience broke into a standing ovation.
I really don't know what to say. Thank you very much. Both Joan and I were always very proud and happy that we were part of the human race who made good music for the earth and for the universe. Thank you.
Yoko tried to have a normal life again. Quote, "I never even thought of the word widow. I thought I was a soldier." She cut her long hair off, in keeping with Japanese grieving traditions. She dressed herself in fur coats and expensive jewelry, granting the rare onlooker at dinner a Mona Lisa smile. She threw parties and mingled with New York's elite. One could find royalty in the art world like Andy Warhol, Jean-Michel Basquiat, Jasper Johns, and Keith Haring at her legendary gatherings. Not to mention all the pop stars. John's old friends Elton John and Harry Nilsson stuck around. Bob Dylan was hanging out with David Bowie, and Iggy Pop was lurking in the kitchen. In 1981, she started dating her decorator, Sam Havatoy. But the crisis continued. One of Yoko's former tarot card readers had a tell-all book, Dakota Days, in the works. He depicted John as a self-obsessed maniac and Yoko a vindictive, spiteful, paranoid dragon lady. A member of John and Yoko's inner circle, Fred Seaman, began stealing things from the Dakota. Her driver tried to extort her, saying he had unflattering audio recordings of Yoko he'd released to the press unless she paid him. In 1984, she lost a lawsuit brought by Double Fantasy producer Jack Douglas and was ordered to pay him over $2.5 million in royalties. Cynthia Lennon sued for Julian's portion of John's estate. In 1988, Albert Goldman released his book about John. Yoko begged their inner circle not to speak to Goldman, but this backfired spectacularly. The book is filled with those who barely knew John and Yoko, either repeating or inventing hearsay. John is painted as an abusive madman. The book accuses John of kicking Sean, a claim Sean himself has denied his entire life. Tired of her denying his existence, Sam broke up with Yoko in 2000. "We had a full life together, but I didn't exist. Only John existed," he said. Yoko tried to put it past her and attend to John's estate. People have always accused Yoko of recklessly spending John's money and profiting of his legacy. This wasn't helped by extortionists and con men calling her pretending to be psychics. Being so superstitious, Yoko trusted them. Through all this chaos, miraculously, her daughter Kyoko resurfaced. It was revealed that for 14 years, Kyoko and her father Tony were members of a cult called the Church of the Living Word. They escaped in 1977, and Tony made a documentary exposing the cult. But Kyoko laid low for a long time after. She feared her father would be imprisoned for kidnapping her when she was a child. Once Yoko assured her she harbored no ill will to Tony and didn't want to put him in jail, mother and daughter finally kindled a relationship. As her friend John Hendricks observed, when Kyoko came back, Yoko was the most whole since John was killed. Having mended her relationship to motherhood in 1997, she debuted the first iteration of My Mommy is Beautiful. Viewers were invited to participate, writing stories about their mothers on pieces of paper and hanging them on a big board. During lockdown, Yoko brought this piece to the internet.
Yoko continued making her art to process her unbelievably tumultuous decade. Though it was the antithesis of the temporal nature of her art, she allowed some of her famous works, like Apple, to be cast in bronze in the 80s. "The 80s were a very bronze decade," she said. I can't help but agree. "Gaudy and ostentatious." She'd stepped back from making music, but Sean encouraged her to get involved again. Together, they made the 1995 album Rising, with Sean's band backing Yoko's signature Yoko sing. "It's the curse, and my curse could be worse. I'm just talking to the universe. I'm just talking to the universe. Ooh. Listen." "Say, Institutions began to show interest in staging retrospective exhibitions. Quote, working with Yoko was unlike working with any other artist, curator Jeffrey Dietsch said. Quote, she creates a... Emma, can you help me with this word?
Gesamtkunstwerk.
A total concept of an immersive art experience.
It literally just means that. It means like a whole art piece, I would say.
This is exactly what the Entrance exhibition, featuring Yoko's half-room piece, was. In 1994, the Yokohama Museum of Art approached her about doing her first retrospective showing. Events like this placed Yoko within the history of contemporary art and outside the long shadow of John Lennon. In 2003, for her 70th birthday, Yoko performed Cut Piece for the first time since the 1960s. At her 80th birthday celebration, she asked Peaches to perform Cut Piece. When Yoko's music was reissued as Ono Box, Yoko became an unexpected dance pop star. You could go to a disco and hear Yoko Ono. Yoko has influenced the likes of the B-52s, Laurie Anderson, even Fiona Apple. You probably know her song, I Want You to Love Me, from TikTok, but if you've only heard it on TikTok, you might not know how the song ends. Totally Yoko. Even Kurt Cobain, who called her the first punk rocker. Kurt was such a big John Lennon fan, he even emulated John and Yoko's relationship dynamic with his own very controversial wife, musician Courtney Love. If Yoko is the most controversial woman in rock and roll history, Courtney is number two. Oh, yeah. Thurston Moore of Sonic Youth has also openly admired Yoko's work. Him and Kim Gordon did a whole album with Yoko called Yoko Kim Thurston. Ironically, the very same year that album was released, he would blow up his own band by having an affair. Not a wise thing to do when your wife is the bassist. Thurston has been happily married to his Yoko, Eva, for 5 years. More recently, Ben Gibbard of Death Cab for Cutie put together the Yoko tribute album, Ocean Child, Songs for Yoko Ono. Waiting for the sunrise, waiting for the sunrise, waiting for the sunrise, waiting for the sunrise, so I can take your hand and stroll about. Waiting for the sunrise. In 2002, Yoko joined the B-52s on stage for a very special performance of Rock Lobster. In 2014, she performed Don't Worry Kyoko, backed by Yola Tengo at the Glastonbury Festival. She looked like she was having the time of her life. The next year, she enjoyed an exhibition at the MoMA for real this time. In his review for the New York Times, Holland Carter attempted to vindicate Yoko. Quote, her position as John's wife obscured her independent career. Worse, it left her a natural target for the misogyny and racism that she had always battled. The year after that, when Donald Trump was elected president the first time, Yoko simply shared a 19-second audio of herself screaming. So relatable.
We get it. We all felt like that.
In 2022, she debuted Arising. Women were invited to share any story of any man who'd harmed them. It was Yoko's expression of solidarity to the hashtag MeToo movement. At the Vancouver installation, one woman wrote hashtag MeToo 500 times. In 2023, Yoko was one of the four female Fluxus artists to be featured in a Japan Society retrospective. In late 2024, when Yoko was 91, the Tate Modern in London opened the most comprehensive retrospective show of her art to date. The Yoko Ono Music of the Mind exhibition was met with rave reviews. As of us posting this episode, Yoko is 92 years old. She handed off the duties of running John's estate to Sean. She's moved out of the Dakota, currently living on the farm upstate. In their adulthood, Julian and Sean have become very close. Julian has a cordial relationship with Yoko. Yoko has never stopped exalting John. In 2006, she dedicated the Imagine Peace Tower near Reykjavik, Iceland, to him. It's lit every year from October 9th to December 8th. So what is the truth about Yoko Ono? Is she a feminist hero? Is she a silent figure dressed in black, always clinging to her messiah husband's shoulder? Is she a martyr? A con artist? A succubus? A witch? Rock and roll's greatest villain? My opinion on Yoko is never static. I'm not nearly as enthusiastic about her as David Sheff. I'm not anti-Yoko either. While I don't much care for her unique vocal stylings, I find her activism pretty to look at, but otherwise ineffective, I respect her deeply as an artist. I admire Yoko for keeping John's legacy alive. Like it or not, our grandchildren will still be getting John Lennon album reissues. Maybe too many. There's a lot to admire about Yoko and John, but their relationship was founded on breaking up families and rooted in a lot of issues on both sides. Talk about codependency. Her treatment of her stepson Julian was cold at best, cruel at worst. Overall, I think Yoko was a victim of a time in history that was just modern enough for her presence, but not nuanced enough for who she is. And who she isn't always flattering. Though there's a lot of black and white in her art, there is no black and white with Yoko Ono. It's all gray. Reducing her to just the good is just as bad as reducing her to just the bad. With these episodes, we hope to show you, listener, the fullest picture of Yoko we can. In doing so, I hope to exalt her lifelong artistic statement. Human suffering is universal, but we're resilient. Together, we can change the world. Thanks for tuning in to the season 2 finale of Unveiling the Legends, Dolls of the 60s and 70s. We hope you enjoyed our journey through the incredible life of Yoko Ono.
As always, we're Emma.
And Abby.
Your hosts, and we're thrilled to have you with us on this groovy adventure. Remember, the spirit of these trailblazing ladies lives on in each one of us, inspiring us to embrace our individuality, creativity, and passion for change.
If you like what you heard, don't forget to subscribe to, rate, and review the show on your favorite streaming platform. Your feedback means the world to us, and it helps others discover the magic of these legendary dolls.
As always, we'd like to thank special friend of the show, Michael Teggio, for the wonderful intro song. Until the next time, keep the music loud, the fashion groovy, and the spirit of the 60s and 70s alive in your hearts.
Peace,
love,
and rock and roll.
We finished another season!